Some legal cases do more than raise eyebrows. They can start a push to change the law. So it is with a federal case in Las Vegas now working its way through the courts. The question is whether federal agents can disrupt service to a house and then, masquerading as helpful technicians, gain entry to covertly search the premises, all in hopes of finding evidence to later justify a search warrant. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
The defendants in this case are not your everyday Americans. They're in fact Chinese gamblers who were in Las Vegas staying at Caesar's Palace. Caesar's and other gambling casinos thrive on these high rollers and provide them with free villas, butlers, and other services. But in this case, at least one of the high rollers had been tossed out of Macau for running an illegal sports betting operation. That fact made the Nevada Gaming Commission and the FBI suspicious that they were doing the same thing here. Suspicions, however, aren't enough for a search warrant, not for my house, not for yours, or for high roller villas. And so, according to court papers filed by defense lawyers late yesterday, the FBI came up with a plan. Working with a computer contractor for Caesars, the agents first tried to get into the villas by delivering laptops and asking to come in to make sure the connections worked. The butler, however, wouldn't let them in, as we hear in this tape of the actual event.
Well, I just want to make sure they can connect before I leave. Can we just make sure they can connect, okay?
I know, but the thing is, you can't go in there right now.
Oh.
Next, the agents came up with what defense lawyer Tom Goldstein calls another trick.
And the trick was, we will cut off their internet access. And when they tell the hotel, hey, it's not working, we'll dress up as technicians, we'll come inside, we'll claim to be fixing the internet connection, even though we can't because we broke it from outside, and then we'll just look around and see what we see.
Once inside, the agents wandered around the premises as they covertly photographed the rooms, entering the previously off-limits media room where a group of men was watching the World Cup soccer game and looking at betting odds on their laptops, something that's perfectly legal in Las Vegas. What else the agents saw is not entirely clear at this point, but when they left, they seemed satisfied that they had enough to get a search warrant and later an indictment.
Yeah, we saw what we needed to see, pretty much.
Very cool.
Defense lawyer Goldstein contends that not only was the search illegal, the government knew it was and tried to cover it up. He contends that the materials submitted to a federal magistrate judge in seeking a warrant later carefully eliminated all indications that the feds had themselves cut the internet line in order to be invited into the villas as repairmen.
They just managed not to tell the magistrate what it is they had actually done.
Indeed, Goldstein says that he and his clients would never have known that it was the FBI that cut the line were it not for one slip of the tongue that the agents made, recorded on tape, when talking amongst themselves. He adds that when the defense asked for further recordings, the FBI provided two blank CDs and said the recording devices malfunctioned.
The bottom line here is there's no real way of looking at this other than to say that it was a cover-up.
Cover-up or not, the legal theory used here by the Justice Department and the FBI would change the legal rules of the road dramatically if adopted by the courts.
The theory behind this search is scary.
George Washington University law professor Stephen Salzberg is the author of a leading criminal law text.
It means the government can cut off your service intentionally and then pretend to be a repair person. And then while they're there, they spend extra time searching your house. It is scary beyond belief.
Salzberg, who has himself worked for the Justice Department, is frankly puzzled by the brazenness of the search here.
It's very difficult to understand unless they want to try to push the law of consent beyond where it's ever gone before.
The Justice Department declined to comment for this story, saying it would make its arguments in court. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
A news organization that focuses on social media called Storyful is little known outside journalism circles, but many of the networks, newspapers, and news sites that Americans turn to for trustworthy information depend on Storyful all the time. As NPR's David Folkenflik reports, it provides journalists with the raw materials and confidence to pursue their own stories.
Say you were noodling through Twitter or Facebook several weeks ago and happened to come across a video that had popped up all over.
Oh, yeah.
The video shows a series of aerial strikes, said to be by the U.S. on fighters for the so-called Islamic State in Syria. It looks pretty authentic, and it is authentic footage of something. But an editor at Storyful warned journalists that the video had first been uploaded 4 years earlier. It had nothing to do with the attacks this fall. Such due diligence is invaluable to news organizations to prevent them from peddling false information or from falling on their collective faces. Indeed, Storyful may be one of the few news organizations in the world where journalists exchange high fives when they identify fakes.
So I'm Mark Little, and I'm the CEO and founder of Storyful, which we like to think about as the first social news agency.
As you may be able to guess from that accent and that voice, Little was previously a foreign correspondent and anchor for a television network in his native Ireland, and he operated for years on the premise that he could take viewers places they couldn't go on their own. But about 5 years ago, as mass protests in Iran were documented on Flickr and YouTube, Little realized that was no longer true.
Our mantra is there's always someone closer to the story.
He built a 24/7 team of several dozen like-minded journalists based in Dublin, New York, and Hong Kong. Their mission? To seek out the best material that others are sharing across social media platforms and to verify it so Storyful's clients can trust it.
We're giving the alert, which says somebody is on the ground, an authentic source. They are there. They are telling us that something has happened dramatically, and we have technology that detects these signals. We then, at that point, help our partners find the content that will define the narrative.
Rupert Murdoch's News Corp acquired Storyful late last year, perceiving both a cutting-edge journalistic model and the promise of profits from clients. Those clients include the New York Times, Al Jazeera, the BBC, People Magazine, Vice, and YouTube, as well as Murdoch's Wall Street Journal and New York Post. Storyful shares a floor in New York City with The Post, a tabloid that just made an undisclosed payment to settle a libel suit by two men it wrongly implicated in the Boston Marathon bombings in a front-page headline. But so far, Storyful is remaining true to its own painstaking approach.
I'm looking for Ram Hamdan, which is the location.
Claims recently spread on Twitter that a suicide attack killed the leader of a Syrian rebel group. Megan Specia, then a duty editor at Storyful, showed me a heat map of postings by social media users who have already been identified as credible.
So plugging in certain key terms, we can have access immediately to searches on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, LiveLeak, Dailymotion, Vimeo, Twitter, and Youku, which really speeds up the discovery process for our journalists and really gives us a chance to harness the best content that's out there.
Specia has since left for the digital media site Mashable. She said Storyful's journalists have to verify every piece of information they want to pass along.
I might look to see who the original uploader is, what types of content they've been sharing in the past, if they seem like a legitimate source to me. And what I'm doing is applying, you know, traditional journalistic skills to a new medium.
Editors run down the origins of dialects on tape, use metadata to figure out when a picture was really uploaded, and check Google Earth to study terrain shown in videos. Sometimes Storyful scrutiny involves playful topics. The organization helped clients steer clear of a viral hoax video about an eagle snatching a toddler in a park, for example. Margarita Noriega is director of social media at the Fusion Cable Network, owned jointly by Disney's ABC News and Univision. Both are clients of Storyful.
It was surprising to see that, in fact, so many newsrooms needed help finding more information. That's not something that I ever thought a newsroom would have a problem with.
Noriega says her sole reservation about Storyful is that it's ripe for competition. A big company like CNN or BuzzFeed or The Times could make the investment to do precisely what Storyful does. In the future, she says, journalists everywhere could be able to do this for themselves.
In the age of the internet, there are dozens and hundreds of stories that you just don't have the bandwidth to cover yourself. So what surprised me was that Storyful actually had a business model to help.
For now, there's little competition in sight. CEO Mark Little says his team's formula blends data sleuthing, language skills, deep knowledge of foreign conflict, and a lot of common sense.
We're very much of the opinion that we're turning content into stories. This is all about storytelling.
It is, Little says. All just reporting for the modern age. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
The filmmaker Jean-Luc Godard made his name in the French New Wave of the 1960s by breaking cinematic rules. Now, at the age of 83, he still does things his way. He takes on 3D in his new film. It's called Goodbye to Language, and it shared the jury prize at the Cannes Film Festival this year. The movie opens in this country today, starting in New York and Los Angeles. Here's reporter Pat Dowell.
In Goodbye to Language, there are some things you might find in any Hollywood movie. A woman and a man arguing. A shootout. There's even a dog, the director's own. Roxy wanders the countryside, conversing with the lake and the river that want to tell him what humans never hear. There are also things typical of movies by Jean-Luc Godard, quotes from philosophers, artists, novelists, as part of the dialogue or recited by a narrator, music where you least expect it and not where you do, a story that's not stitched neatly together, and an unusual approach to 3D. Godard generally avoids interviews, but he did talk for Canon cameras about what attracted him to 3D in the first place.
There aren't any rules. It's still a place where there aren't rules. Later, there are a ton of rules, so that interests me less. You must do this, you must do that, don't do this, do this.
3D uses two cameras to make an image appear to have depth, but Goodbye to Language goes beyond that, says film historian and critic David Bordwell.
Normally, they're interlocked to produce a smooth image, a 3D illusion. But what Godard does in a couple of points in the film is pan one of the two cameras he uses, but keep the other one fixed on the object. So, in fact, you get a splitting of the image, two flat images superimposed on each other in depth. When that first instance of that in the film showed up at Cannes, audiences spontaneously applauded. They had never seen anything like it.
And it's not just for the sake of rule-breaking, says Bordwell.
It's a very startling but kind of poetic effect, actually, particularly in the context of a scene where it's about people separating from one another.
Bordwell likens Godard to a modern painter, and so does one of the film's stars, Eloise Godet. She recalls asking the filmmaker about her character, a woman in an unhappy relationship.
He gave us a picture saying, okay, that's what your character are representing for me. It was a piece of modern art, and it was really abstract. And he said, okay, that's your character. It was weird, but really inspiring.
Weird but inspiring might describe how even Godard's producers see his projects. Vincent Maravel decided to pursue a career in film when he was 14 after seeing a Godard movie. He still finds Godard's work strangely puzzling and compelling, still the creations of a young innovator.
For every project, he's looking for the unknown. He looks for an experience. He doesn't know where he goes, and that's what motivates him, and that's what I call being very young. It's true that he's always ready for adventure.
Godard himself steps into his film, at least through his voice, as an unseen teacher expounding on watercolor painting and questions of existence.
That's what Kirillov says in Dostoevsky's novel.
Go back to the surface.
Two questions, a big one and a little one. But the little one is also big. What's difficult is to fit flatness into depth.
What's the little one?
La souffrance.
Suffering.
Et la grande? And the big one?
L'autre monde.
The other world. The other world.
L'autre monde.
And this may be just what Goodbye to Language is about, says film historian David Bordwell.
I think what he's talking about, and this is one of the reasons the dog Roxy is very prominent in the film, is that he's trying to get people to look at the world in a kind of unspoiled way. There are hints throughout the film that animal consciousness is kind of closer to the world than we are, that language sets up a barrier or filter or screen between us and what's really there. And although the film is full of language, talk, printed texts, and so on, nevertheless, I think there's a sense that he wants the viewer to scrape away a lot of the ordinary conceptions we have about how we communicate and look at the world afresh.
To make us see is one of the oldest goals of movies, and one that has pushed Jean-Luc Godard to keep working for more than half a century. He's already at work on his next film. For NPR News, this is Pat Dowell.